You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 11th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
The United States and the Taliban try to work out whether they can still do business, a new worldwide, well, nearly corporate tax regime, and the corporate rebrand. Is anybody fooled? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Lynn O'Donnell and Vincent McAvaney will be here to discuss all the day's big stories. And as we bear down on Monocle 24's 10th anniversary, we'll continue bringing you our 100 greatest moments, if we say so ourselves. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Lynn O'Donnell, columnist for Foreign Policy magazine and former AP and AFP bureau chief in Afghanistan, and Vincent McAvaney, journalist and Monocle 24 regular politics commentator. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
Vincent, I understand that you have been ticking off yet another semi-post-pandemic milestone. You've been to an actual wedding. Was there a fight in the car park?
There wasn't. No, it was a big wedding, though. It was a friend married the daughter of the head of the Gurkhas, so it was
good
quite
heavens.
An interesting Nepalese wedding experience. Yeah.
Did you have to dress up in traditional garb?
We did not. He did, but we did not. but some friends did wear saris and things, girls. But it was great. It was just nice to be back in that kind of environment again.
I got taken to an Indian wedding once in Calcutta, and with great ceremony was taken out to choose an appropriate, you know, garb for me to wear, and of course inevitably got there, and of course every other actual Indian man was wearing a suit and a tie, wondering why this idiot hadn't seen through the obvious prank to which he had been the victim. I've still got the shirt though, it's very smart. Lynn, you have been in Exeter speaking about the story we're about to speak about.
I was on a panel at Exeter University organised by a professor at the university, Weeda Mehran, who is a friend of mine. She's an Afghan who grew up in Pakistan and then went to university here. She has degrees and PhDs from Oxford and Cambridge.
Okay, well, that does tee up our first story quite nicely, because it is 6 weeks, give or take, since the United States abandoned Afghanistan to the people they'd spent 20 years fighting for control of it. It can at least be said for the United States, perhaps, that they're not sulking. Representatives of the American government and of the Taliban have been meeting in Doha. The Taliban delegation, led by acting Foreign Minister Mullah Amir Khan Muttaqi, have been asking for humanitarian aid, the unfreezing of the reserves of Afghanistan's central bank, and COVID-19 vaccines. Lynn, first of all, and we should remind our listeners that you were yourself in Afghanistan until extremely recently. What is the US doing here? Where is this on the spectrum from just craven capitulation to pragmatic realpolitik, that these people are now in charge, we'll have to deal with them, so we'll deal with them?
It's rather difficult to know, because the Taliban are proving day by day that what they can't do is governance. We knew that when they were in control 96 to 2001, the country fell apart and was very close to a collapse before the invasion of October 7, 2001 drove them from power anyway. And they're really proving all over again. Well, not only that they are the same, but that they are worse, because they've come in with the baggage of factionalism between the various parts that make up the Taliban, including the Haqqani, who are a very brutal terrorist group listed as such. And they've also come in with revenge. So they are still looking for people, searching people out, arresting people, beating people, killing people who were associated with the previous regime.
Vincent, is that perhaps a motivation for the US here, that there are still a lot of people in Afghanistan that the US would like to get out of Afghanistan? And this is not merely people who worked with US forces, but actual US citizens.
Yeah, they do need to, you know, open up these paths of dialogue to try to get people out. We all remember how disastrous things were in the final few days. Many people were left behind over the past couple of weeks. I've done interviews with former broadcast journalists, women who are in hiding in Kabul, who are terrified. terrified, who are having to kind of move locations. They are desperately still pleading with the government here and the government in America to try to get people like them that were participating in civil society out of the country. And for now, it seems like that is incredibly hard to do.
Lynn, I want to go back to that point you were making about the Taliban's lack of aptitude for governance and possibly complete lack of interest in it. And you're quite right. I was briefly in Afghanistan in the late 90s, and yeah, they were absolutely entirely uninterested in undertaking the basics of running a city or indeed running a country. Do you get the sense that there is now perhaps a maybe there's more self-awareness about them than there was 20-odd years ago? They know that they can't do this themselves at some level, and they are trying to see how little they can give away in return for some assistance?
You mean like using women's rights and humanitarian assistance to prevent winter starvation as bargaining chips, perhaps?
Exactly, that.
Yes, it's been suggested bargaining chips for diplomatic recognition, for the release of the $10 billion in financial assets that the United States has frozen, but they also have to play to their own gallery, as it were. We've seen over the past few weeks the decimation of education, girls not allowed to go to school after age 12, not allowed to go to university, women not allowed to work. They're concentrating on the minutiae of what clothing women wear, how long men's beards are, what sort of haircuts they get, instead of running the country. And, you know, they have a relationship of sorts with Islamic State Khorasan, which is the local franchise of ISIS. And ISIS in Afghanistan attracts the hardliners who are disillusioned with the leadership of the Taliban for having any contact at all, let alone a deal with the United States, even though it led to the Trump-Taliban deal of 2020, led to their victory. And so I think that they're caught up in a very difficult situation, that they have to tread a fine line to keep their own supporters, hardline supporters, happy. But they also know that they can't run the country by themselves and that people are going to die if they are not fed and clothed and looked after and the electricity bills aren't paid before the winter really sets in, which isn't far off.
Just to follow that up quickly, Lynn, you mentioned Islamic State. The Taliban have said that one thing they are not going to discuss is any idea of cooperating with the United States in terms of dealing or tackling or containing Islamic State. The Taliban say they can do it alone. And of course, Friday's events in Kunduz, when an Islamic State suicide bomber attacked a mosque with absolutely calamitous consequences, suggest that the Taliban really can't do that alone, even if they are inclined to do that.
But whose word are we taking that it was Islamic State that was responsible for the mosque bombing or even the bombing at the airport during the evacuation process? We're taking the word of liars, drug dealers, misogynists, murderers. I wouldn't be surprised if it was the Haqqani network that was responsible for the airport bombing, and I think it remains to be seen who's really responsible for the mosque bombing. Shias and Hazaras have been targets of the Taliban for very many years. As you know, there have been mass killings in the past, and Shias and Hazara people have been very afraid of the takeover by the Taliban. Many of the people who I know who are Hazara nationality are in hiding if they haven't been able to get out because the Taliban have them in their sights. So I think it remains to be seen. I don't take the Taliban's word for anything. I wouldn't take the Taliban's word that the sun was shining, even if it was, because they've proven themselves to be totally untrustworthy.
Vincent, just as a final thought on this, as we were discussing, there may be pragmatic short-term reasons why the United States thinks it needs to be talking to the Taliban. Do you think that's all there is, or are we edging towards, you know, one day in coming weeks or months, the stars and stripes being hoisted once again over the US embassy in Kabul?
I mean, I really don't know if we'll get to that point in any time soon. I mean, just the logistics of them going back in and being able to operate safely seem incredibly complex at the moment. It is interesting, though, to hear, you know, talking about this. There are parallels. Any kind of political party or governing organisation that is so focused on its ideology always gets completely tripped up like this. They can't ever do it. It's what you see, particularly in Europe with far-right parties, is that when they do sometimes get power, their zest for enforcing their will in the same way the Taliban does on women, for instance, and their sort of really kind of radicalized notions stop them in any way operating a capable state. And it happens at all levels. We've seen it here in the UK when groups in the past decade, like the BNP or UKIP, got control of local councils. They're just failures at running things because they're so ideologue on everything else. And so, I mean, with the Taliban, I think you're right in what you're saying, these chips, you know, holding back women from schools, that is a way that they can try and unlock this aid. But whether or not we ever actually see another embassy opening in you know, particularly with that bombing at the end of the evacuation from the airport, whether or not the embassy will open in the next couple of years, that really remains pretty, I mean, you'd have to be pretty bold if you're Joe Biden to decide, you know, with all the kind of tightness in the US election system at the moment, to open an embassy after things like Benghazi, unless you could really secure the safety of it.
Okay, well, let's move along to our next story, which was the headline which fanfared the G7 summit in Cornwall in June, a 15% minimum corporate tax rate worldwide. That agreement has now been joined by a total of 136 nations, including some, notably Ireland, for whom 15% would represent a pretty serious hike. The idea is, aside from raising extra revenue for post-pandemic economies, a scarcely comprehensible figure of $150 billion has been floated, is that it will make it harder for multinational companies to minimise their tax by shifting profits between jurisdictions. Vincent, I know you have done quite a lot of work on this and were in fact substantially raised in a couple of well-known tax havens. This is basically a good thing, right?
It is basically a good thing. This very much is recognition across the world that this game cannot go on of people crashing their corporate tax rates to lure business in, and therefore other people in other parts of the world with these companies actually are operating, not receiving the fair tax that they should have. And it is definitely interesting. Ireland was the real holdout. And when they fell on Thursday, then you saw the final few joining on Friday as well. And, you know, Ireland had long fought hard to keep its 12.5% tax rate. It was something that had to go up. It was at 10% before this. Then they were, the EU accused that of being state aid. It was a way that they brought in the big US tech companies over the past couple of decades. And those companies are substantial in Ireland, and we will see whether or not Apple and Google keep the level of presence that they had in Ireland. But now, you know, it is going to be a bit of a game changer, because whilst you will continue to have places like the Channel Islands, places like the BVI, where you do have what they call themselves offshore finance centres, but in reality tax havens, there can be still some creative accounting going on there, but you cannot, you know, put like the headquarters of an Apple or a Google onto those islands and run it in the way that you can from developed nations that that have the infrastructure like Ireland does. So it will definitely be a massive change. And I think, you know, the argument that has been made, Joe Biden coming so hard on this, is by governments that they can say, you know, well, this is going to pay for the cost of the pandemic by doing this. And the countries that have, you know, refrain from it, so the four that stayed out are going to, like Sri Lanka, like Pakistan, they're going to come under quite severe pressure to get in line with this and not crash it. But it does have huge consequences, I've got to say, for another country, which is Scotland, which the independence plans that the country had were to match Ireland's corporate tax rates if they ever did get independence, to lure business in. And now they, you know, if they do go for independence, they will not be able to play that card as well. So that's another problem that they're going to have with their economic model for how they would be an independent nation.
Lynn, the OECD is trying to make the case here that this doesn't actually eliminate tax competition, the kind of practice that Vincent was talking about, where countries could make themselves more attractive to foreign investment by lowering corporate tax. The OECD says it just limits it. Is that fair enough?
Is it fair enough in practice that it will make it a more level playing field?
Yeah,
is that what you mean?
Exactly that.
Well, I think they have to justify it. They've, you know, the negotiations of this have been going on for a decade, and that's an awfully long time. And they're not going to bring it in for another few years yet, which is still an awfully long time when you've got big COVID bills to deal with and tax hikes in the meantime that are going to pay for it. I would think that. you know, there are always loopholes. Phalanxes of lawyers will be brought in to make sure that loopholes are available and exploited. Nobody who has, and no corporation that makes billions and billions of dollars does it because they want to pay their taxes.
On that question, Vincent, does it tell us that really, basically, consumers don't actually care about all that much, all this stuff, that we don't, this sentence is all the phrases the wrong way around, you know what I'm trying to say, that we don't see any of the corporate behemoths that this is clearly aimed at. None of them ever want to make a point of saying we pay our taxes, we're good guys, buy our stuff. That doesn't seem to be a pitch that they think will work.
It is strange. And I've talked about with people in the industry about this, that, you know, if there, we see marks now with companies where, you know, they have stamps that show you, oh, we're this level of green, a bit like, you know, with appliances, ABC category. And I just think a system like that with taxation, would, if you set that up, would it actually change people's buying habits? Would they aim for people to purchase from that they know the revenue is going in? And it does, at the end of the day, come down to convenience. That is why, you know, if you look at what happened with Amazon during the course of the pandemic, whilst we were all trying as much as possible to shop locally, and keep businesses afloat, at the end of the day, when you can order whatever you need for homeschooling or whatever it is from Amazon, that is the reason why their profits went into the stratosphere over the last couple of months, a year, you know, the last 18 months of the pandemic, despite the fact we all know that they pay absolutely negligible tax in this country. And we are, you know, losing that revenue that could have gone to a John Lewis or another business that's based in this country to help pay the pandemic bills. No, we've offshored it, essentially.
Is there a case, though, Lynn, that simplifying tax regimes is a good in itself?
Well, as you know, I lived in Hong Kong for some time. Mm. And in Hong Kong, the corporate tax rate was 18% and the personal tax rate at the time I was living there was 15%. And nobody had any choice but to pay, and people paid. And the idea was behind it, and what made it popular, was that if I'm earning £25,000 a year or £1 billion a year, I'm still paying an enormous... If I'm a billionaire, I'm still paying 15% of what I earn, which is an enormous amount if you're earning £1 billion or $1 billion a year. And there was a feeling that because it was well known and because it was well regulated and because you weren't able to get on a plane unless you had paid your bill, that everybody paid. And so nobody minded paying 15%. And since that experience, and I lived in Hong Kong for probably a total of about 7 years, I've been a great supporter of the idea of a flat tax rate.
Lynn O'Donnell and Vincent McAvaney, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Marie Doha-Besancenot is the Brand and Communication Director of Allianz France. Marie Doha-Besancenot, it's great to talk with you. Working together for a sustainable future is a great line, but what does it mean? And how is Allianz working to deliver that?
We secure your future is actually the full raison d'être, as we say in French, of Allianz Group. And lately, it's proven very valuable in a world where resilience has become a key concern. So what does it mean, really? It means Allianz as a group is committed to making decisions based on positive, long-term environmental and societal outcomes. It means that simply that we care for our environment and we want to protect the future of the planet because it directly impacts people's lives. So how do we activate this ambition? Well, by using four great levers that we have to make a difference. First, as an investor. Second, as an insurer. Then as an employer, and then as a corporate citizen, as any citizen, really. So luckily, I would say sustainability has always been in our DNA as an insurer because our daily work is helping people get back on track after an incident. On the financial side, we're also dedicated to ensuring long-term economic value creation to our clients. And on the societal side, I would say we are always on the lookout for the next innovations we want to ensure to help them reach a large market. For example, startups working on new mobility services. But placing sustainability at the heart of our action with this raison d'être means that we take voluntary commitments to go beyond that. And at Allianz France, for example, we chose to formally derive our whole strategy for the next 5 years from this raison d'être. We secure your future. So concretely, it means every business priority in the company takes this ambition seriously into account. And we ask our employees also individually to use it for guidance in their daily work.
Marie Doha-Besancenot, Brand and Communication Director of Allianz France, on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. With Allianz, you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, the Margalies Prize is one of Canada's most notable design awards. It honours Canadian designers who improved aspects of quality of life in Canada's cities. This year's winner is the Toronto-based ecological designer Nina Marie Lister for her work on boosting biodiversity in Canada's urban settings. Monocle's bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, spoke to her and to the Montreal-based urban designer Claude Cormier, who was a member of the jury this year on the role the prize plays in Canadian urban design. Thomas began by asking Nina Marie about what the award means to her.
First, to say it's a lovely surprise. This is not something you self-nominate for, so it's a really affirming thing to have happen. It is an affirmation, right, that one's work is making an impact for the better, one hopes. And in my case, it's been a very long time I've been doing this work. It's not new. And so it is, on top of that, a recognition of a body of work that is value and of benefit. And that's a very inspiring, energizing feeling. My work, put simply, is about connecting people to nature in cities. And that work takes a multitude of different forms. I'm an ecological designer, which means I connect culture and nature through infrastructure designs and through human direction and intention. Could also be policy designs, for example. The design of infrastructure, the design of policy, these are all intentional, directional activities that connect humans and nature. And the ways that I do that are specific in, for example, green infrastructure. So infrastructure, that means bridges, rooftops, living walls, policies that move humans and wildlife safely, policies that allow our cities to flourish with biodiversity, the diversity of living things. And also to do so, as Claude will understand, with joy and with compassion, because this makes every city better. It's especially meaningful for me that Claude was on the jury, because Claude has been a huge inspiration in my work as well. His work on the surface can appear whimsical, joyful, fun, but underneath this very serious work, what you don't see under the ground of a landscape that is intensively, carefully designed with best practices, with best available evidence, the science of how to grow trees, 90% of which is underground, not above ground, right? There's a lot of work there that for me was very inspirational and also, frankly, gave voice and credibility and highlighted the need for the kind of work that I do, which is very much supported by good science, best available evidence, but also needs artful, joyful practice.
And Claude, to come back to you, maybe for a broader view on the prize itself, maybe you could give our listeners a sense of the prize's own story and the role it was trying to occupy, I suppose, as we consider our cities.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. In 2012, the Margolis National Design for Living Prize was established through a gift by the developer in Vancouver called Leonard Hebert Margolis. He left money at university, and with the endowment, there's money that creates a good chunk of money for this big prize every year. And over the years, since 2012, the goal of it was to recognize inspirational Canadian citizens who have improved the built environment. There's a lot of prizes that take care of that, the kind of a very iconic architecture, sustainability and efficiency and all this. But there's not a prize that is about the kind of inspiration for all of this underneath that beauty or this efficiency in the design.
How are you sort of seeing that change from your own vantage point in your own practice over the years? Are you seeing sensibilities kind of shifting in one way or the other, becoming more considerate of certain factors?
There's a gigantic shift, I find. When I started to practice in the practice now, it's that notion of the environment, and I guess, yes, climate change and all this thing, but what does that mean in terms of physicality of what we do, right? It's taking a huge place within the development of public space, and people are interested. I find that the general public are very well educated and informed. And I still believe within this, beauty with all that has a place, right? With all of those living system and social system, my hope is that that's the role of design, that aesthetics should also be built in. And the notion of accessibility in the sense of understanding of what it's done, and this notion also of optimism and fun and pleasure.
Is there anything specific that is unique in a way to sort of the Canadian urban setting in your mind?
Well, that's an interesting question and not one I've actually been asked before. And it's a really important one. You know, I think Canadians perhaps suffer from a certain kind of blindness, a blindness to their own connection to the natural world, which in our country is almost 90% of the land base of 10 million square kilometers is public or crown land. And so perhaps we're not as aware of that privilege, just as though we might not be aware that we have so much access to clean water, for example. And it means that this work then necessarily needs to highlight or shine a light on what that relationship could be, which is why in some ways, you know, a lot of the work has been about safe passage for humans and wildlife, for example, where we are physically quite likely in our growing cities to intersect the path of wildlife. And it begs questions about who belongs where and how we mediate those spaces. So I think there is that element. I also think that we run the risk of perhaps romanticizing the wildlife component internationally, where for some other countries that relationship is gone or not, or even less visible, or arguably in the global south, where the fastest growing cities in the world are directly on the path of some of the world's richest biodiversity, there's a new language of relationship to be explored. So I hope that that's something that we talk about going forward. What is that, the shape of this relationship, what might it be? There are more questions than there are answers, I would say, but they're important to be asking right now.
That was Nina Marie Lister, winner of the Margolese Prize, speaking to our Toronto Bureau Chief, Thomas Lewis. You are listening to The Daily. Still with me are our guests, Vincent McAvenny and Lynn O'Donnell. And off the back of that, I did want to ask you both about how the last 18 months, or if the last 18 months of what we will refer to as the unpleasantness, have changed your experience and understanding of the cities in which you have lived. I've spent a lot more time in London's parks, largely out of necessity. But in London, as I have been reminded, we're pretty fortunate on that front because London's parks are fabulous. Lynn, how has it changed things for you?
Well, like you, I spent a lot of time in the parks as well. I got into the habit of daily walking my hairdresser's dog, Reggie, a boisterous border terrier. And I'm in Pimlico, so I am walking distance to some of the great parks, Battersea to the south, and then St. James's Green Park, Hyde Park, up to Regent's Park. And I did that daily, and we had a sensational summer here
last
year. And so I felt very privileged to do that. And I must admit that I do love an empty city. I used to love when I was in Hong Kong and in China at Chinese New Year because it was all very quiet. And I love the Christmas New Year period when it goes very quiet, especially here in the UK because it's cosy as well. But I tell you what, 18 months of that, it did wear a bit thin. A quiet city for a short time is a good thing.
I agree. I have a soft spot for the quiet city. When I used to live nearer the city of London, I used to enjoy walking around the city of London on Sunday afternoons when, of course, there is nobody there. But it did strike me quite early in the pandemic that, as I did, standing in the middle of Oxford Circus on a bright Tuesday afternoon in about April and not being able to see a human being for 360 degrees in any direction, that's not quite right. I do wish I'd taken photos, but that was a strange moment.
Well, I did take photos. I've got that on record. It was scary after a while, and that's not why we live in cities. We live in cities for vibrancy and a dynamic lifestyle.
Vincent, what's changed for you? What have you found yourself appreciating more or less than you might have done?
Well, yeah, obviously the parks. We all got to know the parks in London very well. I'm down in Greenwich in southeast London, so Greenwich Park is now very, very familiar. But I'm also very fortunate to be, and this was, I'd lived in central London for kind of many years and then moved out to Greenwich to be a little bit more by the river. And just being by body of water, I think it was really calming. It just gives you a sense of openness sometimes in the city. So I very much thanked my 2016 self for that move during the course of the pandemic. But it was, I mean, my experience was slightly different, I think, to a lot of people's, in that because I was a broadcast journalist and was doing a lot of TV lives and reporting, I was, you know, not just in London, but in cities across the UK where there should normally be absolute bustle and you're just standing alone on the busiest streets in the country. And it did, you know, it played with your mind a lot. It did very much feel apocalyptic and it was a very strange thing. The one thing that I did kind of come to like slightly about London, like you're saying, it was a bit like the kind of, you know, that little bit between Christmas and New Year's or the Sunday in the city, is that actually when the city was quieter, you paid attention a lot more to kind of the buildings and what was around you. And I spotted things that I've just, you know, you're in a rush to get somewhere and there's crowds and there were actually bits of the city where I was like, I've never noticed this part before. I've never seen this before. The one thing I would say, though, did worry me is a story I did in the summer, is there's a practice now in London councils called infilling, which is, I think, something we're going to see a lot more of in London in this race that they have to build more properties, is that whilst I think the big parks are quite protected, your Hyde Park, your Regent's Park, all of those, a lot of the small bits of green and common land that are currently owned by councils, including the kind of green parts between existing council blocks, are all being developed. And the development is a kind of, there is council and there is a bit of private mix, and they're saying that they're putting, you know, roof gardens and things on them as well. But that will, I think, change in the next couple of years. I think a lot, and starting to see it a little bit in, it's in Lewisham, starting to see it in Greenwich as well, a lot of the nice little smaller bits of green are suddenly turning into building sites under the new rules that have come in.
Well, let us turn to something altogether more prosaic, i.e. the corporate rebrand, which is something of a high wire act in that when you get it wrong, the consequences are both spectacular and memorable. Here in the UK, nearly 20 years later, guffaws can still be raised by the recollection of the Royal Mail, one of the most recognised brands on earth, never mind this country, relaunching as Consignia, to a chorus of incredulous, derisive laughter and re-embracing its original name swiftly afterwards. China's luxury brand Behemoth Fosun is to rename itself entirely after one of its best-known possessions, the French couturier Lanvin. Lynn, it's not hard to see what they're doing here, I don't think. Fosun is, of course, this enormous behemoth founded in 1992, Lanvin, this very niche, famous brand founded in 1898. Fosun's trying to buy itself a bit of cachet in history here, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. It also owns a slew of other high-end brands, Wolford, Sergio Rossi Shoes, a couple of others.
And Wolverhampton Wanderers.
Well, there you go. I mean, how high can you go? But I think it makes sense. They're an expansionist corporation and high fashion is global. You can go from one city to another anywhere on any side of the world, and the same brands will have a resonance with fashion consumers. So I don't blame them for wanting to position themselves with a recognisable high-end luxury brand that they hope will expand their sales base.
Vincent, does it end up affecting, though, how consumers see the product? As Lynn mentioned, some of the brands that Fosun owns, and I mentioned Wolverhampton Wanderers, but they also own St. John Knitwear in the United States and Harvard Dead Sea Skincare, the Israeli brand. Does it make it feel like a less exciting thing to own if you sort of realise that this thing which you have bought, which has an association with a terroir, if you will, which I clearly cannot pronounce, associated with a particular location, it just turns out to be one of dozens of brand owned by this enormous conglomerate somewhere?
I mean, it's an interesting one because this rebrand is kind of, you know, they've obviously got this asset that they actually think, let's put it to work. And whether or not the mind of the consumer is going to be really changed by the fact that it is, you know, they might now be aware from the coverage that there are all these side things to it. I think it's interesting, though, when companies do this. I was involved in something in the last couple of years where Comcast, the kind of US telecommunications absolute giant, was making this big push into Europe with news. And it's about, you know, some companies, what they think travels well. And whereas NBC is a massive name in US broadcasting, when they initially, their initial strategy was to take over Euronews and rebrand it as Euronews NBC. And then when they actually managed to get Sky, then they kind of backed out of that. But in the testing that they did, as I recall at the time, within Comcast itself, the motto is spread the peacock, because that's the NBC logo is the peacock. And so anything they buy gets a peacock slapped on it. And they did a whole bunch of testing around Europe. And, you know, they thought, oh, yeah, the NBC name, they'll love it. And, you know, Europeans just shrug. If you're not aware of the brand, it doesn't matter how prestigious you think it is. If there's no awareness in a market, it doesn't matter. And it's interesting with Sky, then they were going to launch a news channel called Sky NBC News because they couldn't decide which one was the bigger global brand. That was abolished. But now it's interesting that they do own, obviously, Sky here. And I think that is going to get a peacock on it at some point. So it is interesting what cultures in corporates think about how important their brands are.
Lynn, does it become a thing, though, when the particular brand does have certainly an association with a particular country, as Lanvin does? People will think of that and they think of France, but there are companies like Jaguar and Land Rover and Rolls-Royce which have sold themselves for years as I think almost literally the best of British, that these are definitive British marks, and when you buy one of these, you are buying something of whatever it is that theoretically makes Britain great. But of course, Jaguar and Land Rover now owned by Tata of India, Rolls-Royce by BMW. Does that make any difference to how people see the actual product?
Well, I guess that depends on how well the new owner holds on to the quality, not just the perception of quality, but the quality of the brand. Because I think you can sell something as being of very high quality, but if it's not, if it falls short of expectation, it doesn't take long for that to come and bite you. I think what the Chinese brand, Foshan in this case, is going to be challenged with is making sure that along with the name, it holds on to the perception of elegance and quality and workmanship that Lanvin, the brand, carries with it. I don't see why it shouldn't, because its other brands are also high-end luxury. But if you don't sell the quality that you are purporting to sell, you won't sell it on the basis of that quality for long, because it does catch up with you. I mean, look at what Volkswagen did with the the pollution. That has really damaged the brand, and it takes a long time to build a reputation, as we know, and not very long at all to destroy it.
I think there's an interesting comparison as well with the Royal Bank of Scotland. So when it was going through its kind of expansionist phase and it was buying up other banks, the most prestigious one was it bought NatWest, National Westminster Bank, in the UK. And it continued to operate it as NatWest, but their moves at the time were to kind of convert more of them into Royal Bank of Scotland and spread the RBS name. And then obviously the 2008 crash happens, RBS had so much bad debt on their books, and the company name was, you know, Fred the Shred, the kind of deposed knight that led the company, became the villain of it all. But they pursued with the Royal Bank of Scotland name for, you know, a couple of years. But in 2017, they finally just realised it was too toxic. There was also, you know, move to Scottish independence. And was that impacting customers' perception of Scotland, you know, Royal Bank of Scotland as well? And it's now interesting that you actually don't find Royal Bank of Scotland. And this is something they did. They pushed it all through in the pandemic, actually. You don't find now RBS branches anywhere outside of Scotland. They've all been flipped to NatWest ones, which was, you know, the company buying this other brand and then actually having to subsume itself with their branding in order to, you know, protect themselves and the toxic legacy the original brand had.
Vincent McAvenny and Lynn O'Donnell, thank you both very much for joining us. Finally, on today's show, as we've mentioned before, and by golly, we'll mention again, it is our birthday week here on Monocle 24 as we turn 10 years old, and we are counting down some of our favourite moments of that past decade on air. In this clip from 2012, so this is very early on, this is vintage coloured vinyl on Sub Pop Monocle 24. We sent our Australian reporter Adrian Craddock to Helsinki to partake in a traditional Finnish sauna.
Really, my shoes here.
Okay.
You have their own little compartment. You can put your valuables in a small drawer.
I'm kind of nervous, Thomas.
Yeah. So the main attraction is the wood burning sauna, which is just around the corner.
So we're not actually in the sauna yet, because it's quite hot in here. I thought we were actually here.
No, this is not it. this is the dressing room, and below on the ground floor there's a pool. I think it's 25 meters.
Okay.
Pool, and it's always been a nude pool and kind of a nude bath. So since the 20s, it's alternative days for men and women. And I think a couple of years ago, it was for the first time it was allowed to wear a swimsuit, but I don't think anyone does that. So, you just look at how other people behave, and I think you'll be fine.
I'm kind of nervous, man. It'll be fine. I'm sure it'll be fine. Oh, Jesus. Oh dear. Oh dear. So, taking off the old belt. And I'm nude. There it is. There it is. It's very hot now. Mate, it's really hot here. What is it? No, it's like, oh my God, it just hits you in the face. So, what's the feeling that you get after the sauna? What's the appeal of the sauna?
Well, I think we're going to feel it after the sauna, aren't we? But it's very kind of deeply relaxing. So as you, you kind of move between hot and the hot and the cold. It speeds up your metabolism, and you sweat, and somehow I guess you feel a kind of you feel purified, mm-hmm. and then you feel very relaxed in general, mm-hmm. and it's a feeling that that you start to miss when you don't have it.
Mm-hmm. So guys, just come in. He's gonna put some steam on. There we go. Hear that?
Authentic voice is coming.
Oh yeah.
It increases the moisture.
Yeah. Right, let's set up. Oh, that feeling is pretty amazing. Like now it's like really refreshing. So we've just come out. Now it's time to get in the showers again. So you were saying there's a cafe here, there's a pool, there's lots of things that you can do here. But you have this new idea for Helsinki. Can you explain it a bit? Can you explain what your idea is?
Well, Helsinki and Finnish cities have had this tradition and culture of public baths, public bathing in the form of sauna for a very long time. And Helsinki used to have over 200 public saunas in the 1920s, for example. Now there's only three left, this one, and then two in Kallio on the kind of east side of the center. And so there's like three, four saunas left out of the 200, and there hasn't been a new public sauna for about 50 years. And somehow the building that we're now constructing, that we will run together with my wife starting the end of this year, is it's definitely a sauna. It's primarily a sauna, but it does have, like here, it has the opportunity to swim, in our case in the sea. It's situated just on the waterfront, so the building two facades actually rise out from the harbor. Mm-hmm. And then we have a courtyard which is kind of enclosed by the building on three sides, and one side is just the sea. And so there's an opportunity to swim like here, and also we have a small cafe, kind of kiosk inside with a cafe, or it's the space where you go to kind of sit like we are right now, with a bathrobe or a towel on, and maybe have a drink, because you lose a lot of moisture when you're in the sauna by sweating. You really need to replenish. So drinking and then eating something salty is really nice. It's really part of the experience, so it makes sense to have an opportunity for that. So it's typically it's either a sausage or some pickles or something like this, and then things to drink.
We've just ordered some mead, yeah. Funnily enough. So cheers.
Sima.
Yeah. It's very civilized.
They make it here. It's their. This is one of the few places where you can drink mead in September.
Amazing. As the founder and also as an architect, those two roles, it must be a pretty impressive building. I imagine that you've kind of. It must be something else.
Well, I think the sauna as a building type is really exciting from an architectural point of view. I mean, if you think of a museum, you need to have a collection, or you know, you need to have the works there, or in a restaurant you need to have the food. But the sauna is a building where the architecture actually produces the experience. But it needs to be an architecture of where you can't make any shortcuts, you can't do compromises, because it's, you know, looking at it from a kind of, you know, physics, it's extremely hot. There's a lot of humidity. The kind of flow of air, the flow of people, the dimensions. There's a lot of extremes. It has to really perform well functionally. It has to perform well technically. It has to perform well from a mood point of view. And then you know, it really has to kind of come together in a special way. And this is all, the entire experience is produced by architecture. And in our case also, the kind of the possibility to propose a building on an extremely unusual site in the center of, in the kind of heart of the city, and to kind of somehow manage to negotiate it through all the possible obstacles and actually make it happen.
So, should we head off? Should we go?
Yeah, why not? Do you feel refreshed?
Absolutely. Yeah. It wasn't that bad at all. It was actually quite nice.
Yeah.
It wasn't weird at all.
No, this is it's very classic.
A blast from Monocle's distant past there. That's Adrian Craddock reporting from Helsinki in 2012. The highlight, we hope, of our 10th anniversary celebrations this week is, of course, the Monocle Media Summit on Thursday here in London. Tickets are still available from our website, and a live version of this very programme will be broadcast from the thing itself at 1800. What could possibly go wrong? Come along and find out. That's all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Lynn O'Donnell and Vincent McAvaney, also to Thomas Lewis in Toronto. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Monocle Media Summit is back. Join our editors for a look at the brands, correspondents, and titles that are shaping the media landscape and steering its future. This year, the event will also mark Monocle 24's 10th birthday, so we're putting a special focus on broadcast media. A packed afternoon of panels will once again be hosted by Monocle's founder Tyler Brulé and editor-in-chief Andrew Tuck, along with colleagues from print and radio. The session will feature insights from a stellar lineup of industry leaders, like CNN chief international correspondent Clarissa Ward, Bild-Zeitung's deputy editor and chief international reporter Paul Ronsheimer, Zeit Magazin's Christoph Ament, author and researcher Jess Henderson, Finnish TV anchor Matti Ronka, and his BBC TV and radio counterpart Michel Hussein. Plus, there's a chance to watch a special live broadcast of the Monocle Daily on location. And after that, you can meet and talk shop with the speakers and the Monocle crew over drinks. The Monocle Media Summit is taking place on Thursday, the 14th of October, at the Hyatt Regency London, the Churchill Hotel, W1. As a Monocle listener, you can get 10% off your ticket. Head to monocle.com now and enter the promo code M24Birthday. We look forward to seeing you there.